Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Claire McDonnell, and at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday the 17th of September, these are our main stories. Today, a familiar story from Afghanistan, explosions and deaths. The BBC discovers more people were killed there in August than in Syria and Yemen combined. The highest court in the UK hears evidence that the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson misled Parliament and the Queen over his true intentions for shutting down Parliament. And in Canada, a senior intelligence official has been arrested in what could be the largest security breach in the country's history. Also in this podcast, tens of thousands under threat as Indonesia wildfires burn out of control. And
I tried a little bit of champagne. It didn't go down very well. And I have been eating some M&Ms. I feel just mostly stunned right now. I just can't believe that we did it.
Not once, not twice, not three times. We hear from the first person to swim the English Channel four times non-stop. But we start in Afghanistan. Violence continues to plague the country. And on the day that dozens of people were killed at an election rally, BBC research suggests the number of civilian deaths in the conflict is even higher than previously thought. During the month of August, a BBC team attempted to document every instance of conflict-related violence in the country. They found 2,300 people were killed in August. Up to 500 of them were civilians. This comes as peace talks between the Taliban and the United States have broken down. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, has been travelling in the northwest province of Herat.
We've arrived now in the village of Ahmedabad. It's a cluster of mud dwellings with their traditional rounded roofs. And as always, a crowd is forming. But here comes the village elder with his pure white turban, his grey beard and wizened face. He's wearing a long copper-coloured tunic, and he'll know what's been happening here.
We had a very bad situation here. The Taliban was here, and every other day there was fighting going on. So both sides, the police and the Taliban, got casualties. Even on the crossfire, some children and women of us got injured. At one time, we decided to leave this area because both sides were firing at us, the government and also the Taliban. But we didn't have any other place to go, and we lost our people.
And do you worry the war is going to get worse, or could the situation become more peaceful for your village?
If we have a good police, we might have a good security. If we don't, we might not.
We've come inside this small mud dwelling. It seems to be a shop. There's grapes in a box and tomatoes, and Ahmedabad sitting on the mud floor on his haunches, peeling a sweet melon. What was it like here during the fighting?
The fighting times, so we don't know who is firing at us. So one side the government, the other side was the Taliban. But now security is good.
Do you fear there's going to be fighting again?
We always have this fear that there will be fighting again.
When do you think this war is going to end?
God knows, but if the Taliban and the government sit with each other and solve the problem and bring peace, otherwise God knows when we will have a peace.
But you think there can be peace with the Taliban?
I hope that everybody got tired of war. We want peace, and I hope that we'll have peace one day.
That's just one snapshot, one village in Afghanistan in a war that for Afghans has been dragging on for 40 years. For the United States, it is their longest war, 18 years. And you'll remember how 18 years ago, when the Taliban were ousted from power, Afghanistan never left our headlines. And now it just flickers in and out when there's a mass slaughter, like 92 dying in a packed wedding hall. But the data we collected through all of August, our BBC teams across the country, underlined that Afghans are dying every single day. And I was quite staggered to see that in August, more civilians died in Afghanistan than in Syria and Yemen combined. That's a statistic no country should want to have. But sadly, you heard from the village elder or the shopkeeper saying, we fear more fighting. And that's what Afghans fear now, not towards move towards peace, but a move towards more war.
Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette. The Supreme Court in London, the highest court in the UK, is examining if the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson misled the Queen and undermined Parliament by advising her to suspend Parliament for 5 weeks in the run-up to the Brexit deadline. Lady Hale, President of the Supreme Court, opened the proceedings.
We have before us two appeals, one from England and Wales and one from Scotland. They both involve the same issue: whether it was lawful for the Prime Minister to advise Her Majesty to authorise the prorogation of Parliament by order in Council. That this is a serious and difficult question of law is amply demonstrated by the fact that three senior judges in Scotland have reached a different conclusion from three senior judges in England and Wales. The Supreme Court exists to decide such difficult questions of law, and we shall do so in accordance with our judicial oaths.
Well, 11 justices will hear the case, so is it likely to be a setback for the British Prime Minister? Robert Buckland is the Justice Secretary.
The government will be arguing over the next few days that it was an entirely proper course to take. But, you know, I want to say this about our judges. They are world class, they are world leading, and we must let them do their job. And I want to make sure that whatever the decision is of the Supreme Court, that we respect the robust independence of our judiciary.
Well, our political correspondent Rob Watson has been telling me the significance of the case.
So what this case is all about, Claire, is whether A, it's perfectly OK, whether the court should be getting involved, whether this is a matter for judges, and if they are, whether Scotland's highest court was right last week, that essentially Mr Johnson had lied to the country and to the Queen about his reason for suspending Parliament. The allegation being that the reason he suspended Parliament was to avoid Parliament doing what it's supposed to be doing, which was asking difficult questions about government policy.
And the possible outcomes then, not only for him, but the legal and constitutional ramifications.
Yes, well, it's perfectly possible, of course, that the Supreme Court will say, look, whether Mr Johnson was telling porkies or not, whether he was lying, it's just none of this is a matter for the courts. This is a political issue, whether, you know, whether the Prime Minister was right, improper, whatever, to suspend Parliament. It's also possible, of course, that they may say, actually, it is a matter for the courts, and Mr Johnson was wrong to do this, in which case, of course, it would be very serious for the Prime Minister in two ways. Number one, because Parliament would be recalled and could be asking all sorts of difficult questions for him about how any negotiations with the European Union is going. But also it would be difficult because effectively the Supreme Court of the land will have agreed with the Scottish Court that the Prime Minister had not been entirely truthful either with the country or with Her Majesty.
And what might be the knock-on effect for him? He's still the Prime Minister. Could that be challenged in any way if that were the outcome?
Well, look, I mean, all of this is we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves, Claire. I mean, who knows how the court will find. I mean, if it finds in his favour, if the Supreme Court decides, look, actually, this just isn't a matter for the courts and it's up to the Prime Minister to decide whether Parliament should be suspended, I suspect he will breathe a certain sigh of relief, although, of course, the entire court procedure will have been very damaging. I mean, if it finds against him, Parliament is recalled and there are sort of questions about his truthfulness and credibility, well, one imagines Mr Johnson would have to think very seriously about whether he was able to continue.
Rob Watson. To Canada now, where a senior federal intelligence official has been arrested on charges of stealing classified information. Some people are calling it the largest security breach in the country's history. Cameron Ortiz, the leader of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police's own intelligence unit, was charged with leaking or offering to share intelligence. Jessica Davis used to work for the Canadian Secret Service.
Cameron Ortiz is alleged to have transmitted some sort of information back in 2015 to someone who shouldn't have had access to it. And he's also alleged to have prepared other information for transmission to another party. So really what it comes down to is he's dealing with classified information of the most sensitive nature in Canada, and he's preparing to give or sell it to someone for some unknown reason. under Canadian legislation, there's this concept of called special operational information. It's a special category of classification in terms of the sensitivity of the information. In Canada, that means it's sources of information. So human sources could be covered, methods of intelligence collection, other things like military plans, or the way that the government of Canada goes about securing its information infrastructure. That's the information that he's accused of preparing to transmit. We really don't have any sense of who or what that could be. So there's been some speculation that it could be really a case of espionage. Some have tied some links to China and Russia because of some very circumstantial pieces of information that have come out about Mr. Ordis's background or some investigations that he's working on. But what it comes down to right now, we really don't know. He was in a really unique position in the RCMP that dealt with both RCMP operational, so investigative information, so from a law enforcement perspective, but also the classified intelligence from Canadian agencies, but also from allies. And this is really unique in Canada because there's a significant separation between the intelligence world and the law enforcement world. And he was one of the few people entrusted to sit at the intersection of those two places. It does seem like the bulk of the information was stopped before it was transmitted to whoever was supposed to be on the receiving end of it. You know, the idea here is that it seems that this has been stopped before that's happened.
That's former Canadian Secret Service officer Jessica Davis. Forest fires in Indonesia on the islands of Sumatra and Borneo have been raging for weeks, blanketing the region with smog. The fires occur every year, but this time the effects are worse than ever, and tens of thousands are facing the threat of severe health problems in the region. These residents of Borneo explain what it's like living in the shadow of the fires.
It's so dark during the day. We have to have the lights on in the house. It feels like night during the day. It's so dark. In the morning, it feels like we are living in a cloud, yellow smog. It's really horrible.
In some areas in the capital, the visibility is less than 100 meters. My asthma is bad, and I have a sore throat. I need to wear an N95 special health mask everywhere I go. It's not comfortable to go outside. We really need rain. We are hoping for rain to clear the air.
Well, Rebecca Henschke is our Asia editor and a former Indonesia correspondent. She's experienced the fires.
The hospitals say they're struggling to cope with the amount of people coming in with breathing problems, skin problems, eye irritations, particularly affecting young children. Schools have been closed and the government is trying to set up areas where women with young babies can be in some way safe from this yellow smog that's just all around you when you enter into these fire areas. I mean, the worst fires in two decades were in 2015 when I was there, and reports say it led to the deaths of 100,000 people at that time, and we're reaching those kind of levels again this year.
What kind of action then, Rebecca, is the government taking, A, to stop these fires starting in the first place? And what is it doing, you know, once they take hold?
Well, what they're doing as they take hold now is the Indonesian president has been in some of the fires areas today. He's sent in thousands of troops, firefighters. They're trying to water drop these areas with helicopters. But really, these fires that are burning underground in deep peatland won't be put out until there are heavy rains. And that's not expected to come till the end of October. So as you pointed out, it's really a question of making sure they don't start. And they are started illegally, man-made fires by people clearing land for pulp and paper plantations, as well as palm oil.
Rebecca Henschke. Now, it may go down as one of the greatest feats of human endurance. A woman has successfully swum between England and France four times in a row without stopping. And at a distance of more than 200 kilometres, it was actually an even tougher challenge than it was meant to be. This report from Jonathan Savage.
At its narrowest point, the English Channel, or La Manche if you're French, is a little over 33 kilometres across. Many have taken on the challenge of a single crossing, but early on Tuesday morning, after 54 hours and 10 minutes of non-stop swimming, Sarah Thomas touched land for the fourth and final time. A remarkable achievement and a world first.
I'm pretty tired and I can barely talk. Coming back from France the last time was definitely hard. It took forever and the current pushed me all over, and my mouth is totally raw from all the salt water. And it wasn't as cold as I thought it might be, but it was chilly. I almost didn't go back when I got back to England. I thought I should just finish and quit. And my team said, guess what? You can do better. You can keep going.
It should have been a total swim of 129 kilometres, but the tidal pools of the world's busiest shipping lane increased the distance Sarah had to travel by more than 60%. Watching on was official timekeeper Kevin Murphy.
History's been made. To be honest, we're all a bit emotional. I just don't understand how she has kept going at the speed that she's kept going at for so long. And what makes it even more amazing is the fact that she is still receiving treatment for breast cancer. She wanted to prove to herself that she could beat the cancer. She has proved it.
Only four swimmers had previously crossed the channel three times without stopping, and some people's minds will naturally turn to the question of what's next. Who, if anyone, will dare to attempt the crossing five times? But on completing her swim, Sarah Thomas had ambitions that were understandably more pedestrian.
Well, I'd like to get clean. I've got a lot of gunk all over me, and then I hope to sleep all day long.
Jonathan Savage with that report. Still to come on this podcast, we hear claims that the spirit of the Basque separatist group ETA is still very much alive in Spain. And the 2-metre giant salamander, that's not quite what we thought it was. Did Apple have a $14 billion sweetheart tax deal with Ireland? The EU says the tech giant benefited from illegal state aid, and 3 years ago it ordered Apple to pay back the money to the Irish government. But Apple and the Irish government say the deal is perfectly legal. The case is being heard in the European Court. So what precisely is the EU objecting to? Andrew Walker is our business correspondent.
An arrangement that Ireland made with Apple, which essentially put the company's profits on the sales of Apple products in the European Union into a what was called a head office, which, according to the European Commission, had no premises, had no employees, and it enabled Apple to essentially, in the Commission's line of reasoning, to pay no taxes on the profits it made in the EU. Now, the Commission says that that was essentially a special deal with Apple, so it was something that was not available to other companies and therefore was a favoured arrangement for the company, not available to other businesses, and that would put it in violation of the EU's state aid rules.
So the defence from Apple and the Irish government is what exactly?
Well, they both argue that there have been a number of legal errors in the Commission's reasoning, that they have misunderstood the way in which Ireland's tax law operates. And one particularly striking thing that the Irish government suggests is that by intruding into this question of exactly how Ireland's tax laws are interpreted, it is essentially violating the country's sovereignty, because national tax law is very much something that is a matter of the individual EU member states' competence. It's not a matter for the EU itself.
Andrew Walker. A former US Marine, Paul Whelan, who's accused of spying in Russia, has had an appeal against his detention denied by a court in Moscow. The Russian government alleges he was caught red-handed with state secrets last December. In a statement to the court, Mr. Whelan, who also has British, Irish and Canadian passports, said he was not a spy and that he'd been set up by a Russian agent. Our Moscow correspondent Sarah Rainsford was in court.
It's now 9 months since Paul Whelan's arrest, and this is the first time he's described in person his side of the story. In a glass cage in court, with masked guards from Russia's FSB security service looking on, the former US Marine told the BBC he was not a spy and had been set up during a visit to Moscow for a friend's wedding by a man he'd known for years. That man, Mr. Whelan said, had turned up at his hotel room unannounced and put a flash drive into his pocket. The government here has described him as getting caught red-handed with state secrets. But Mr. Whelan, who's also a British citizen, says he only knew the drive was there when the FSB burst in to arrest him. The investigation has now ended and Mr. Whelan's lawyers have begun studying the evidence. As an espionage case, it's all classified, but they say the files reveal that he'd been under surveillance for some time, his conversations and movements monitored. Still, They told the BBC they've seen no proof, so far, of his guilt. Paul Whelan's frustration, meanwhile, is clearly increasing. When the judge returned to read his verdict that he should be kept in custody ahead of trial, he raised his own voice to denounce the case as a provocation and nonsense, and called on all four governments whose passports he holds for their help.
Sarah Rainsford. On Wednesday, the Supreme Court in Spain is due to hear an appeal by a group of prisoners jailed in the separatist Basque area in the north of the country, who say their sentences were politically motivated. The Basque separatist group ETA ended its campaign of violence 8 years ago and disbanded in 2018. But some believe the spirit of ETA is still very much alive. Guy Hedgko reports.
In a square in the small town of Alsasua, people gather to voice their support for several local youths who were in prison for assaulting two plainclothes civil guards in a bar in 2016. Prosecutors brought terrorism charges against 8 defendants, claiming that the attack on the policeman, one of whom suffered a broken ankle, had been politically motivated. Video footage was recorded at the scene moments after the incident, apparently showing one of the injured civil guards in a heated exchange with some local people. The terrorism charges were eventually dropped, but 7 of the defendants were given jail sentences of between 9 and 13 years.
My name is Aicea Ramirez de Alda, and I'm the sister of Adu Ramirez de Alda, one of the guys who is in prison since almost 3 years ago, and he has a sentence of 12 years.
Like many people in Alsasua, Aicea Ramirez de Alda says the case is full of irregularities.
The state wanted an exemplary punishment, so they have used this town as a circus.
But many on the political right see Alsasua as evidence that the kind of extremism once embodied by ETA is rife in northern Spain. Javier Esparza is leader of the Navarre People's Union. At its headquarters in Pamplona, he shows me photos of 2 former colleagues who were killed by ETA. Mr. Esparza says the radical pro-independence left, once closely linked to ETA and now in mainstream politics, has a strong presence in towns like Alsasua.
They were attacked because they were civil guards, and this has a political context. Before, civil guards used to get murdered, now they get beaten up.
From what you're saying, you seem to think that the legacy or influence of ETA is somehow still present. Is that the case?
Without a doubt. Its political arm is in our institutions, and its political arm is on the street.
Every year, Alsasua holds the Ospa Eguna, or Day of Farewell. Local people take part in a series of festive activities, including a banquet in the town square, and here, a cross-country run. All with a single, very serious message, that Spanish security forces stationed in the town are not welcome. Many locals complain of constant police harassment. One activist who helped organise this year's event and prefers not to give his name explains the reasoning behind it.
We campaign for the removal of the forces of occupation, that is, the civil guard and the regional police, all the police and military forces that we believe do not belong in the Basque homeland.
What do you say to people who say that the influence of ETA can still be felt in towns like this one?
People in the Spanish state can think what they like, and we don't have to defend ourselves from accusations which are obviously false.
The fallout from a now notorious incident in a bar shows that the peace which has arrived in northern Spain in recent years remains an uneasy one.
Guy Hedgko reporting. Finally, scientists from the Zoological Society of London believe they've identified the world's largest amphibian, measuring around 2 metres in length. It was always thought that the Chinese giant salamander was a single species, but according to our environment correspondent Helen Briggs, the research suggests there are at least 2 species of the critically endangered amphibian.
What we think we have is the world's biggest amphibian. It's a giant salamander, so a very strange-looking creature. Some people think of it as a giant brown blob with eyes. It lives in mountainous streams in China. Now, we know it's one of the biggest amphibians, but we thought there was only one species. And now, from trawling around at museum specimens collected decades ago, they've been able to extract DNA and found there are, in fact, three different species. So why is that important? The key thing, really, is it affects their conservation. Because even though, paradoxically, there are a lot of these animals farmed in China, millions of them, there's almost no or none of them left in the wild at all. They're down to very low numbers. So if you want to save them in the wild, so you're saving what some people call a living fossil, it's been on the planet for millions of years, it's a very important animal to scientists, then you have to alter your conservation measures because these are sometimes released from farms. They can spread disease, they can breed out the ones, the really rare ones. So it's time to look at conservation plans if there's time left to save them.
So we know that there are three different species now, and that's through the DNA. But do we know whether they are still out there in the wild?
It's a really good question because they go and survey for them, but they live in mountainous streams. It's very hard to see them. And the last survey they did, they only really found a handful across China. And they're not quite sure which species is where. They're geographically separated, though. But the farmed ones are sometimes released and then they will breed. So it's a question of really finding out what's out there. And then ideally, you wouldn't release them at all. So the scientists are calling for more conservation efforts to protect them, and one of which is to not move them around. And that's quite a big deal, really, in terms of actually saving them.
And just describe, I've got a picture in front of me of this salamander. Not the prettiest of things, but, you know, a wonder of nature. Tell us what it looks like.
Yeah, well, it's up to 2 metres long, so about as long as a king-size bed, weighs more than 100 pounds. And you know, some people sort of see it looks like a bit of a snake. It's been described as a Loch Ness monster, all sorts of things. So really weird and wonderful and, you know, a living fossil. So it harks back to millions of years ago when we had all sorts of weird and wonderful animals on the planet.
And if I came across it, would it eat me or is it not interested?
No, I don't think it would be very interested. It's a top predator in its streams, but it's more interested in other things swimming around in the streams and the rivers.
What a relief. Helen Briggs reporting there. And that is all from us for now. But just before we go,
the documentary podcast from the BBC World Service takes you to surprising and unexpected places.
This place is so strange.
I'm Asif Kapadia. And that's exactly what's happened to the people in my new series of shows.
Yeah. And any moment that elephant can decide, come and destroy your house.
In association with Sundance Institute.
You're not afraid. No.
We'll be meeting people who have taken a detour from the path they thought they were on.
At the beginning, I wanted to be something real and useful.
And ended up somewhere completely different.
The worst moment of my life was fleeing from my country in the middle of the night.
How did I get there?
There's no worse transition than this.
And how did I feel about it?
It doesn't make sense at all.
That's Detours on the documentary podcast from the BBC World Service.
I really believe that I'm making some change.
Just search for the documentary wherever you get your podcast.
I'm Claire McDonnell, and until next time, goodbye.